Welcome to the main event. Let's get ready to rumble!
Lone Wolf Radio calling. Lone Wolf Radio calling. This is Lone Wolf Radio with your host, Tom Metzger. As they say in Hollywood, it's on with the show.
And it's July the 26th, 2017, Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day. How about that? Well, it's cooling down out here in sunny Southern California beneath the palm trees. I'm surrounded by about 100 giant palm trees here, and it almost makes me want to put on my grass skirt and do the hula hula, baby. Well, how they doing with La Cesspool Grande? Yeah. La Cesspool Grande. It's getting grander all the time, huh? How about that? I noticed by my waveform on my picture show here that I had a little too much amplitude. I've got it cut down now. I hope I don't have it cut down too low. Well, let's see what we're going to do today to have fun and get in trouble or stay out of trouble. I don't know, man. You know, Wednesday's a good day to get in trouble. Let's go back in the archive to September 1998, Liberty Bell and an author, Alan Callahan. Never knew Alan Callahan. He wrote a lot of good articles. And I'm not sure whether he's still around or not. Who knows? Here we go. Now, this is one of my favorite characters we're going to talk about. A war criminal that I really can't stand and never could stand. Well, at one time when I was in junior high school and the Republicans were running this war criminal for president, they were handing out stuff to kids on the street. They had this thing, they'd give you a badge you put on and a couple little trinkets. And they called it the I Club. Yeah, I belonged to the I Like I Club because I didn't know shit about politics. They were just using me back then as they used everybody else later. And they're still using them about the unglorious warmonger and war criminal, Dwight D. Eisenhower. Yeah, you heard it. All you right-wing guys from down south, you tend to stick with these guys more than anybody else. ZOG, our Zionist Occupation Government, pretends to be very keen on publishing or punishing war criminals. I call this hypocrisy, but the ZOG can easily prove otherwise by punishing one of its own from its war for Jewish predominance. As far as I know, the word war criminal were not used back in the days of Oliver Cromwell. Had they been, possibly Charles II and his supporters might have used them after the Restoration because they wanted to punish Cromwell in some way. They couldn't do so in the normal sense, he being already dead, but they wanted to do something that would be symbolic or that would send a message. So Cromwell was one of those rare individuals who was hanged after he was dead. Charles II hated him because Cromwell was instrumental in having his father, Charles I, beheaded. A few years after Cromwell's death, his body was dug up from Westminster Abbey and hanged on a triple gibbet at Tyburn. Two of his generals were hanged with him, and the bodies of his mother, sister, and granddaughter were dragged from their graves. They knew how to get even back then. After 6 hours, Cromwell and his two generals were taken down, beheaded, and the bodies thrown into a deep pit by the gibbet. The heads were taken to Westminster Hall, stuck on poles, and left there till at least 1684, or 23 years after being exhumed. Wow. Afterward, the mummified head of Cromwell was kept for various periods by different people till March 25, 1960, when it was finally interred near Sidney Sussex College, Cambridge, his alma mater, in the secret spot near the chapel. Did Cromwell deserve all this? Well, he did treat Ireland with great severity and exiled a large number of Englishmen who opposed his rule and gave him trouble to the northern part of that country. In most respects, however, his administration was well run. The public revenues were economically managed, and every man was given liberty of conscience. Cromwell was a great statesman and civil administrator, and his personal habits, temperament, and industriousness, and even though he thought Charles I should die, he was courteous and kind to his three young children, who were held captive by the parliamentary army, even going so far as to kneel to them in loyalty. As President Eisenhower was, it seems, a fairly able administrator, doing pretty well in handling the economy, and he did a good thing in getting the interstate highway system started, but as a general, he was terribly cruel to his German POWs after the war ended. Incidentally, that interstate highway system was not to be directly to benefit the people. It was building a military highway system in case the Russians attacked. Anyone who has read Other Losses by James Bach of Stoddard Publishing Company in Canada should feel sickened afterward by the horrors brought to light there, the treatment of German soldiers after the war. Eisenhower didn't just starve his prisoners for about a year after the World War II ended. He also did other horrible things, like sometimes shutting off the water in some of the camps for up to 3 days at a time, forcing some of the prisoners to drink their own urine. He also denied many shelter, sanitary facilities, and medical care. Mail service was withheld for about a year until the spring of 46. Six prisoners often had to sleep in the mud while nearby hospital beds sat empty. I never could figure out why there isn't an everlasting hatred of the United States by these Germans that were treated that way, and also the desire to get even. About 1 million died from starvation, disease, neglect, and other cruelties. It is pretty obvious as to why. Eisenhower apparently had long hated the Germans, but what really sent him into towing rage was his visits to some of the German internment camps as soon as the war ended. In some, but not all, there was a lot of sick, starving, and dead inmates lying around. These were caused by the conditions of the war and were not part of any extermination policy. Yes, the things that engaged him the most were caused by the military actions of his own forces, particularly the raids by his air fleets, What did he think his bombers were dropping? Flowers on German white working class neighborhoods? Now what about the final solution? Yes, there was such a plan, but it meant resettlement, not extermination. An obnoxious American once asked Hitler where he got his ideas for his policies towards the Jews, and he said he got them from us, from our treatment of the Indians. Mongoloids. We resettled a lot of them on reservations during the 19th century, but World War II profoundly changed the resettlement plans of National Socialists. Many Jews were resettled before, during, and after the war, however. Eisenhower was part Jew and was questioned about that when he sought to enter West Point. The Academy was more concerned about things like this in those days, but unfortunately let him in anyway. How much his Jewishness had to do with his actions is anyone's guess. Similar to what my wife used to say, you don't have to be a Jew to be a bastard, but it helps. But it most likely had something to do with it. Maybe he was just taking a leaf from the book of his tribal god, Yahweh. This deity hated the human race so much that he drowned the whole kit and caboose. Except for Noah and his family, he even drowned all the animals, saving only the smidgen on the ark. We don't know why he targeted them, also as they were innocent. Eisenhower gave lip service to the Geneva Convention, while at the same time secretly undercutting it to an astounding degree. He claimed there was a food shortage, but this was a lie. The wheat production that was lost in Germany and France was more than made up by the yields in the UK and North America. There was also plenty of corn, the largest production of potatoes ever. Why didn't the few food shortages also affect the POWs under British and Canadian control? They were able to feed their prisoners adequately. At any rate, if there really had been a shortage, and Eisenhower couldn't feed his POWs, why didn't he just release them? The tough-talking but humane-acting General George Patton started releasing his prisoners as fast as he could and let go many before he was stopped. He was then relieved of his command and transferred to a position where he couldn't release any more. Eisenhower said the Germans were beasts, while Patton said they were the most decent people in Europe. There were plenty of supplies. General Everett Hughes said on the third month, 19, day 45, after visiting a huge supply depot in Naples and Marseille, that there were more stocks than we could ever use. Stretch as far as the eye can see. No really incriminating orders, of course, were ever signed by Eisenhower. Instead, he used winks and nods with certain top deputies. All told, the number who knew exactly what was going on numbered at a minimum of 23. He kept the press out of the camps, saying that there was typhus in them and other diseases. True, but they were caused by him. The dense overcrowding in the barbed wire cages eased because of the massive death rates. The rations for U.S. troops were set at 4,000 calories per day. Most of the prisoners got far less than 2,000, Eisenhower claimed they were getting, and in many cases far less than half. The prisoners could not write and tell anyone what was going on because no mail was allowed out, as aforementioned, mail service was withheld for about a year. Red Cross parcels were not allowed in either, nor ICRC delegates. Hitler had allowed the organization to bring in extra food for Allied prisoners in Germany, but Eisenhower would not allow them to help feed German prisoners, nor would he let the German civilians help. even threatening them with death if they tried to slip any food in through the wire. Two freight trains from Switzerland loaded with food were sent into Germany. They were told that the warehouses were full and were not allowed to unload. They returned to Switzerland. Also, consider the American General Mark Clark took very good care of his POWs in Italy, a food shortage hogwash. The only shortage of any kind was a shortage of common decency in the makeup of the part Jew Dwight D. Eisenhower. We can imagine him sitting in his opulent office, never once deigning to set his polished boots down into the muck and mire that his prisoners were living and sleeping in, gloating and delighting in the misery and suffering he was causing and the deaths. After the soldiers were dead, one final indignity awaited them. Before they were thrown upon trucks like garbage, their clothing was stripped off along with their watches and jewelry and sold on the black market in Germany. Former Attorney General of the U.S. Francis Biddle visited this market and called it terrific. To sum up, I don't know if Oliver Cromwell deserved to be hanged after he was dead or not. Probably not, but Charles II and his royalists wanted to make a point, and they made it. Now you might ask if Eisenhower deserves the same treatment. Well, personally, I think hanging is too good for him, but it would make a point. Zog says it wants to punish all war criminals. And not a bigger one ever lived than Dwight D. Eisenhower. He may very well be the granddaddy of them all. Hanging him would show that Zog is sincere, and that would make a strong point. Can you think of a stronger one? And that's the end of a great article there by Callahan. Yes, sir. Remember, it was Eisenhower and Nixon that engineered the attack on Little Rock, Arkansas, when the people were trying to fight off the forced integration of the schools. And they conferred quite a bit before sending the military in to do it. So there's another war crime that Dwight D. Eisenhower was in on, and Richard Nixon. You got to remember this stuff, because you won't get it from most places. They just keep telling what wonderful people, what wonderful heroes all these people were. Well, I'm going to, while I'm still around, every time I get a chance, I'm going to expose them. Not that they haven't been exposed before, but I want to do it again and again and again. I see by my waveform here that I'm probably overmodulating somewhat in this show, so I hope it's understandable. Do you remember Y2K? Do you remember Y2K and the panic that they've spread all around the country and the world that everything was going to come to an end? Oh, doomsday, my doomsday, wherefore art thou doomsday? I was recently sent a report, the day the world shuts down. This was printed in September 1998. Apparently written by Bruce Tipperary, who may or may not have been a little tippery when he wrote it. He wants to sell you something, of course, but has to properly deaden your senses and unlock your wallet first. He tries to do this by yammering about the already yammered about Y2K computer bug. The Y means the year, and the 2K stands for 2000, thus the year 2000. Everyone from the Christian TV dimwit duel, Mr. and Mrs. Jack Van Imp, to the local geek has heard about this asteroid of virtual space and has joined the silly choir. Salesman Bruce starts out by stating that computer programmers decided way back in the dark 60s that they would save valuable computer memory space by shortening the year dates, such as 1976, to 76. Thus, in ignorance, they are told, doing their customers one giant favor. The purpose was to save space by eliminating two digits or two bytes. as it were, to try this nonsense into perspective, I'll mention the familiar 3-inch popular computer diskette, which most of you people out there won't remember. This iron oxide coated wafer of plastic contains about 14 square inches of area, which is room for 1.4 million bytes. One byte, therefore, occupies the same physical space as does the cross section of a single hair. How many two-digit year dates occurred in any representative batch of computer code or data? A little reflection. The calculator work, if you are so inclined, readily points out the fallacy of this so-called space-saving. Space-saving is generally accomplished by compression or other algorithms. Salesman Bruce continues the fable. With the mark that when the year odometer rolls over to 00, the processing will assume that the year 1900 is meant. This will cause bank accounts to vanish, insurance policies to be canceled, missiles to be launched, drinking water to stop flowing, and probably toenail fungus. Although he frequently uses crash to describe every computer problem under the sun, let it be known that crash means one of two things. One, smoke rolls out of somewhere because of a physical failure of a bit of man-made junk, thus causing the computer to go physically ape. And two, the program itself goes bluey and internally chases its own tail, thus making it appear that everything has gone to meet that great virtual spirit in the sky. Salesman Bruce, in addition to his already growing pile of fertilizer, tosses on another scoop by stating that 99 is used often to terminate a computer's operation. Wow! See the implications of that one. Honor students would certainly be annoyed when their grades caused a computer to flip out. Imagine a grocery business during a 99-cent sale. 'Tis gossip that Bruce is dealing with, and most of it's pure sausage. Often during the input of data, the computer has no way of knowing where the end of it is. Thus, computers often invoke ways to tag the data stream and an end value which has not occurred previously. 99 has certainly been used for this purpose, but it has never, to my knowledge, been used as a command to stop a computer operation altogether, as in Bruce's propaganda. Assuming that 99 is a command, then how could the computer distinguish this from 99 as a data item or address reference? It does this by accepting those bytes within a certain context, as do we when we hear things such as there, there are, there, or your, and so on. Salesman Bruce has all the banks going loopy at certain times depending upon which flavor of loopy he is dispensing. Banks do use computers. Banks do use pencils. Banks do employ people. If all the employees at your bank instantly died from overtaxation, would the bank cease operation? If the pencil sharpener busted its blade, would the bank shut down until the pyramids turned into pillars of salt? Bank computer operations are printed out, and this is called hard copy. This paper pile is microfilmed, often microfiche, and then stored in vaults. This represents their permanent set of data. If electricity suddenly stopped, a far more serious problem than anything emanating from some computer network follow-up, I'm sure the bank would find a way to send the ATF to your home, complete with tanks, flamethrowers, and anthrax, in order to collect that mortgage payment. If the electricity continued to flow and the computers all went to virtual nirvana, that payment notice would still be online and only a quick trip to Zimbabwe would get you off the payment book. Salesman Bruce would also have you believe that the Pentagon would grow a sixth side and that entire military would be shut down depending upon when those nasty 99s appear. Since the friendly business of the military is death and destruction, I'm confident that they have alternative plans. The military always leaves room for and welcomes schemes for contingencies. Even guard duty has its supernumeraries, as all servicemen recognize. As an aside, the military does its thing as a matter of business with not an ounce of hate to be found. It is an observable fact that the more mischief has been perpetrated in the name of love than it ever has been under the flag of hate. Salesman Bruce has all the aircraft control towers going bananas. Woe to the airborne. He conveniently ignores those thousands of airports which have no computers at all and operate entirely by radio communication. Even without radios, people still have eyeballs, haven't they? All pilots are required to know the red, green, white light signals. Sure, there would be a crash, a smash, and a flop once in a while, here or there. Heck, this happens even with computers, or haven't you been paying attention to the news lately? What with high-tech equipment being progressively manned by low-tech help, it might not be such a bad idea if the computers indeed all burned down. It might be well to remember that the 1948 Berlin airlift, Operation Vittles, lasted over 1 year, was one of the most congested airport uses of all time, was done with makeshift control towers and no computers at all. The traffic controllers are policemen of busy air corridors. Computers are one of their handy electronic tools, which are no better than the people who utilize them. At one time, before the blockheads decided to meddle with the world's best public education system, youngsters were taught Roman numerals and given a taste of the Julian calendar. In essence, the Julian calendar was the day count from day one, that is, the beginning of the beginning. Thus, July 4th, 1997, was Julian Day 2,450,634, as counted from some point in the 4000-5000 BC period. I forgot exactly when. July 4th, 1998 is day number 2,450,999, which is 365 days after. No surprise for those who have mastered subtraction. This daily count is very convenient for exacting the number of days from one point to another. Many things are reckoned by merely counting days, since a certain event without the necessity of a Gregorian date ever arising. All sorts of enterprises, from banks to internet servers, use a similar day count from one identified zero date. From this count, the month, the day, the year are calculated. No big deal. I have a tiny program which accepts dates in the usual MMDDYY format, where the YY represents the year sans and the 19 prefix which identifies the century. A peek at the code shows how easily one can slightly alter a handful of bytes so that it is workable for another and multiple centuries. How much written code is out there which needs this tweaking is anyone's business. However, anyone with an IQ above that of a prune could have foreseen such problems years ago. I have often wondered how any programmer could be this blind to future dates, but then again, our present system of education is like the old gray mare. She ain't what she used to be. Salesman Bruce has something to sell after you are sufficiently brain-rattled and pale. He offers an exclusive and extensive Y2K preparation, protection, and survival kit. Surprise, surprise. And when the Y2K non-event arrives, Bruce will be happily spending the money the sucker sent to him, caveat emptor. What shall I do as the millions of horrified boobs pester everyone under the sun, asking them if they are year 2000 compliant? You'll find me safely removed, giggling to myself and drinking my hot Ovaltine. What have we learned? Salesman Bruce first creates the problem in your noggin, then he offers to sell you a remedy. Snake oil has always been popular here in America. that's funny. Here's a note added onto this article. I'm indeed indebted to Dan Parker for the following. Occasionally I read that what someone has to say about Y2K just to sort of get an idea of how their brain works and what their politics might be. So I read your recent essay on the subject and thought I'd send a few comments your way. As a software developer with almost two decades of experience, I have my view of the Y2K matter also. Mine is very simple, though. Not unlike the Y2K problem itself, you understand how simple the problem is technically, and that alone sets you apart from most who comment on Y2K. I think you missed the mark a little, though. The problem is simple, and all of us who actually know how computers and programs that execute on them work know that. However, it is made difficult by this simple little bug, or stupid negligence in engineering. Because it is so widespread, there are a lot of obsolete systems or legacy systems with this bug, and to fix them all takes a lot of work. I wonder why the conspiracy crackpots haven't claimed that all of those bugs were intentionally planted to create a multi-billion dollar industry. Pervasive as it is, the Y2K bugs are not going to bring the system down. Anyone who thinks it even can be as a pea brain has some vested interest in making people think it can, i.e. Hal Lindsey, Vac, Jack Van Imp, and all. And that's the end of that article. Well, see, it was supposed to happen in 2000, and here were our people exposing the fraud 2 years before. So we're pretty smart. We got some pretty smart cookies out there. Yeah. Well, I think we're on a roll here, so I'm going to do another, at least one more article here, because these articles out of Liberty Bell were just fantastic, fantastic, and I really thank Odin or whoever, or Thor or Mickey Mouse, that I kept them, these magazines. And I think the guy that used to work with the publisher of Liberty Bell, took them all and made a website someplace. Now, we have put them on our website, thanks to Bob back east. We put tons of them up there, but there's a lot more out there that we didn't get that I think are floating around up there someplace on the web. When Moses Levy, Karl Marx, penned his manifesto, few imagined that rather than eliminating poverty and social inequalities, it would serve as a tool for the actual mass murder of close to 100 million Christians, or white people, or otherwise, non-Marxist. When Lenin, Trotsky, and the other 1917 revolutionaries seized power in Russia, there were no plans to murder entire segments of the population, at least that anyone knew about. Rather, the Bolsheviks represented that they were empowering the people, the proletariat, and were going to create a workers' paradise. Further, as a tool to help smash the industrial bourgeois and individual nation states, free trade was to be promoted, a along with cooperation with international banking and financial interests. This included the taking of substantial lines of credit and complete protection of banking interests in revolutionary Russia. I called that state capitalism. Now that communism is dead, and I would argue it's not, we are told that they just changed names. We are told there can be no repeat of its horrors. Yet in America, it is apparent from the federal activities in the recent years that the Bolshevist repressive structure is being recreated here, aided and abetted by those having a common religious ancestry with the creators of the original. But where are the rank and file troops? Well, I've said this a long time ago. A lot of the worst elements of communist philosophy, Marxist philosophy, Bolshevik philosophy, were imported after the Soviet Union fell. And, of course, even while it was going on, the whole civil rights race-mixing program came right out of Russia. And if you don't believe it, look it up. Even your enemies will tell you, because they think it's wonderful. I think one only need look as far as the Zionist-inspired philosophy of neoconservatism, the neocons, to find individuals sufficiently mindless and willing to put into place a system that will destroy the values they claim to hold dear. Yeah, that's why the Democrats claim democracy. And they're no more democratic than the man in the moon. Right now, they're working as fast as they can to create a war between the United States and Russia. The Democrats, that in the 60s, was it the 60s? Well, even the 50s, they were promoting peace and love with the Soviet Union. But now that the communist element is pretty much trashed in Russia, they go the other way. It's easy to see. Or people got a brain. With the neoconservatism, class enemy is officially ephemeral liberal. However, in reality, it is the poor and homeless burdens on society whose wishing to be paid a living wage, and wackos, including all non-kosher political activists, white separatists, and so on. These will have to get out and get non-existent jobs or presumably starve. That's why there hasn't been any raises in labor price since the 70s. People are still making money like they did in the 70s. I mean the poor people, or even the middle class. A good example of this philosophy is provided by Rush Limbaugh. In between pro-Israeli promotions, rantings about an alleged Holocaust, and attacks on far-right wackos, as exemplified by the Freeman, David Koresh, and white separatists, Limbaugh promotes free trade agreements such as NAFTA. Incidentally, NAFTA has destroyed the Mexican farmers and caused millions of more Mexicans to come into the United States. That put American whites in competition with slave labor worldwide. Furthermore, he portrays the Federal Reserve credit system as benign and even beneficial to middle America. He supports elimination of most welfare, and he is vociferous in his support of federal and other police enforcement conducted against criminals, drug, and wackos, along with the massive standing army type police justice and prison system that entails. In reality, the neoconservatism proposed by Limbaugh and a host of other promoters that control the right wing has resulted and will result in the export of the bulk of living wage jobs overseas and will depress wage rates in remaining production industrial jobs. Further, creating service sector jobs are barely sufficient to supply a single person, yet alone a family. You see, this stuff was written years before our present modern problems came up. I mean, this was our people predicting and showing what was going to happen. The unemployment and underemployment created by the free trade policy forced many individuals into forms of welfare and break up and prevent the formation of families. The neoconservatives' answer is to block welfare, food stamps, and other forms of assistance. Presumably, those cut off can either find non-existent jobs or starve like the Ukrainians under Stalin. Well, yeah, a lot of people didn't seem to understand that the biggest percentage of people receiving welfare assistance were white. You know, they were talked into the situation where it was all the blacks or the Mexicans or somebody else, when in reality we were working against our own interests. In a non-debt-based system, the savings from cheap slave labor produce would at least free up capital for economic expansion. However, with a debt system beloved by neoconservatives, all surplus capital is soaked up for interest payments, now the largest federal budget item. This system also dooms most small business and so-called engine of the neoconservative economy to the statistical likelihood of bankruptcy, since the Federal Reserve does not expand the FRN credit supply fast enough to allow net payments of outstanding debt. Well, you see what happened after this article was written. We had the crash in the banks' bailouts, and hardly anybody went to jail, right? They call this a democracy? It's not even a republic. As small businesses are systematically eliminated by the growing debt monster, their founders gradually join the ranks of those displaced by free trade. Neoconservatives frequently claim to be for tax cuts to, as Limbaugh puts it, empower middle America. However, the free trade policies have eliminated huge amounts of tax revenues from import tariffs that have been shifted to middle America. This is reminiscent of the Bolshevik maxim, quote, all power to the people, and about as true. Ultimately, the neoconservative rhetoric of empowerment is just that. An elimination of regulation is but a code phrase for allowing the business and financial powers that promote neoconservatism to do as they wish. Now, you see, in this jumping on the bandwagon with Trump, how the right wing is in bed with the neoconservatives. And the not-so-bright white people are going right along with it, including people from the racial movement and all these little groups like the Hollywood Nazis and Hollywood Klan. The neoconservative support of massive prison building, overpaid law dogs, making three or more times what their charges are paid, and a host of judicial hangers-on, and much like ancient pyramid building in that it temporarily disguises the economic rot. But like Bolshevism, the neoconservative hodgepodge is doomed to fail, and so these prisons will be needed after all. That's why Trump has reopened the private prison business, which is another way the ruling class is making a fortune. One thing I would like to recommend people that can do it is to buy a few pieces of stock in the prison system, in the private prison system, and give these stock to our friends, POWs, in their name, so that at least they're in prison making money off the prison. You get what I mean? And I haven't got that set up yet, but I'd like to find out how simple it would be to buy a piece of stock or two, and then donate it to a prisoner. I think that would embarrass the shit out of the system. Neoconservatism cannot produce any more than the failed leftist policies it proposes to replace, i.e. impoverishment, excessive concentration of wealth, which we've got here in this country. A very teeny tiny percentage of people control all the wealth. And the only reason you don't recognize it is because of credit. As long as there's credit, you don't get it. Or most people don't get it. You say, what do you mean? I can buy groceries. I can buy a TV. You know. Abortion and illegitimacy due to financial stress, unemployment, depressed wage rates, bankruptcy, and eventual political liquidation and mass murder to deal with the resulting unrest, which will be coming down the road. And when it happens in this country, it's going to be worse than the Civil War. The very neoconservatives parroting demands for reduction in constitutional rights to trap criminals, drug pushers, and wackos, and demanding prisons and Arizona-style concentration camps and chain gangs, while ignoring the economic causes of many of these problems, may one day find themselves on the receiving end. Ditto. Because as old line Bolsheviks were eventually liquidated after they had helped eliminate the initial target groups, neoconservatives may find that they are not held to be as valuable by their Zionist masters as they vainly believe themselves to be. And that's the end of that article. And in many ways, Liberty Bell was futuristic. It was telling what was going to happen before it happened. Should have been taught in the schools, read in the schools. So you might ask when people ask, well, what did you do? What did you guys back there do? Did you do anything? Well, our people were doing all kinds of stuff, man, with almost no money and working their ass off to try to pull the irons out of the fire and get us out of war and all that kind of stuff. But we were up against a tremendous force. And it's there, and the only way that's going to disappear is a you-know-what. Well, I think that's it for today, and we'll be back tomorrow on Thursday to make you happy, tell you things that are going to make you happy.
Patience and fortitude. Patience and fortitude. Come your way. Patience and fortitude. Patience and fortitude. Patience and fortitude. And things will come your way. When you have solitude, can make life dull and crude. Patience and fortitude. The match wouldn't wait for the cake to bake, but now I can see it's a big mistake. Patience and fortitude. Patience and fortitude. Patience and fortitude. And things will come your way. River wears away the rock with patience. Rust will spoil the strongest lock with patient fortitude. Grindstone wears away the knife with patient fortitude. Same applies to nag and wife with patient fortitude. Patience and fortitude. good race with patient fortitude. Slow and steady wins first place with patient fortitude. If you freeze in ice and snow
with patient fortitude.